Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. Well, it might not have escaped your notice that over the past 20 or 30 years or so, as a nation, we've been growing bigger and bigger. I mean, it sometimes seems like what used to be overweight is now the new norm, right? The new normal. So that's what we're going to talk about today. We're going to talk about obesity. My guest is Dr. Claire Wang, who is the Associate Professor of Health Policy and Management at Columbia University in New York, from where she's joining us today, and is also a co-director of the Obesity Prevention Initiative. And she's interested in controllable risk factors like diet, exercise, and preventive screening in general and how they reduce the risk of disease, but especially obesity and cardiovascular disease. And she's also been heavily involved in research on the effects of soft drink consumption and the health and economic impacts of imposing excise taxes on sugar-sweetened beverages, such as has been done in New York City and other places in the recent past. Welcome, Dr. Wang.
Thanks for having me.
Can we call you Claire?
Yes.
Off the top, what are the statistics on obesity nowadays among children and adults in the U.S.?
Sure. Currently, about 1 in 3 adults in the United States and 1 in 6 kids, including children and adolescents, are considered obese. So what is obesity? For someone who is about 5'8", over 165 pounds will mean overweight, and over 200 pounds or so will mean obese. Currently, no state had a prevalence of obesity less than 20%. And there are 2 states in America, Mississippi and West Virginia, had a prevalence of obesity of 35% or greater. That's based on the Center for Disease Prevention and Control statistics.
So that's about 1 in 3 adults in those 2 states, but nationwide, what does it run, I guess, among adults?
This is a very tricky point, Court. These state-specific statistics are based on self-report, so they tend to underestimate how many adults and kids are obese. But using the nationwide measured data, what we found is about 1 in 3 adults are considered obese.
What's the difference between being overweight and being obese? I mean, I think there's a body mass index number or something, but I mean, just in general, what is the difference between overweight and obese?
Well, according to the body mass index, a BMI over 30 is considered obese, and a BMI between 25 and 30 is considered overweight. Being in the obese range raised the disease risk a lot more than being overweight.
So I think you said a few minutes ago that someone who is 5'8 and weighs over 165 pounds is obese, right?
Is overweight.
Is overweight.
Overweight range.
Okay.
And over 200 pounds or so is in the obese range.
Okay, because I was thinking that wasn't that heavy, 165 pounds at that weight, so that makes more sense.
Right.
Well, is obesity now considered a disease? I mean, I think it used to just be considered a condition, you know, he's fat or whatever, but is it considered by the medical profession anyway to be a disease?
Yes. The American Medical Association, as well as a few other scientific societies, have defined obesity as a disease. But it has been an epidemic for a while, since the late 70s, early 80s, that when we observe the average body size and the proportion of adults and kids being in the obese category, it has been increased over the past 2 or 3 decades. But only until recently, a few professional organizations started to define obesity as a disease.
Yeah, I myself, I definitely noticed a ramp up in it, you know, in traveling around and going through airports around the country and so on, a ramp up in very overweight people, maybe I would say in the mid-80s to the late 80s, in that time frame, where it became much more noticeable to me. But so that kind of jibes with what you were saying. I mean, if it is considered to be an epidemic, right, then we think of epidemics as having public health consequences and economic consequences and so on. So where does it rank against other public health problems such as alcoholism or drug use and tobacco use?
So according to the latest analyses, obesity, overweight, has about to surpass cigarette smoking as the number one public health issues in this country.
Wow. All right. So just being overweight itself is a circumstance. But what other health problems does it cause then that lead to death and illness? And, you know, what other illnesses, you know, come downstream from being overweight and obese?
Right. Not so much with overweight, but once getting into the obese, and particularly in the severe obese range, a range of health issues will start to arise. The number one problem we concern about is diabetes. This is type 2 diabetes, and also heart disease, stroke, and many forms of cancer. So these health conditions will really just cause obese individuals, and especially severely obese individuals, to live shorter and sicker lives. But one thing we often don't talk about are things like back pain, joint problems, is also a severe consequence of being obese or severely obese.
Yeah, I think you're right. You see people walking, and you know, it seems to me you're talking about somebody walking along with a steamer trunk tied to their waist. I mean, you know, and it must to me seem so difficult to move around. In some way, I'm impressed that people can move as well as they do, you know. But is that and foot problems, I suppose, and joint, you know, knee problems and so on. So is that a big factor? I know that, you know, the type 2 diabetes you mentioned, and cardiovascular disease and stroke and heart attack and so on are issues there. But so the physical problems are also a big recognized result of obesity.
That's right. And that's why we really believe that prevention is key, because treating obesity or losing weight is difficult. Partly is because when we're in the overweight range, making exercise and moving around a lot harder, especially at the time when we started to have joint problems, pain associated with this, it's much harder to pick up new exercise habits and lose the weight you already put on. You know, beyond the joint problems and back pains, diabetes, cancer, and heart disease, we also shouldn't overlook the consequence in terms of psychologically. It is very difficult, especially for a kid, to be obese and severely obese in schools.
Well, that depends on how common it is, I suppose. I mean, I can remember in the 50s and 60s being a kid in school, and there were really very few obese children. And now I suspect it's much more prevalent. So is there still a, you know, kind of a bullying aspect to it or a teasing aspect to it? Is it still considered out of the mainstream for kids or not?
Absolutely. So the bullying and also psychologically sort of this deviating from healthy growth is never easy in schools and among your peers. Moreover, we actually started to see health problems started to appear for children and teens who are in the severely obese range.
You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Dr. Claire Wang, who is a professor of health policy at Columbia University in New York. And she's the director or co-director of an obesity prevention initiative and studies, basically, as the title of that initiative might imply, studies obesity, among other things, in this country from all its different aspects. It started to be clear to me, just as a layperson, well, I don't know, 30 years or so ago, that the main cause of it is our addiction to sugar. I can remember I got kind of hooked on lemon drops for a while, and I would eat like a little tin of lemon drops a day, and I put on 20 pounds over 6 months. And when I quit, I shrank off 20 pounds very quickly. So as you were saying, it is, like all addictions, it's difficult to quit, and especially one that becomes, that has physical ramifications to it that make it, in effect, harder to reverse the behaviors that led to it to start with. It leads to the question, which is more important, diet or exercise, in dealing with the weight gain and then trying to lose weight as well? In this whole picture of obesity, is what you eat and how you eat more important than how you exercise or don't exercise, or are they kind of equal and there's a two-way street between them?
Well, the answer is certainly both. And yes, the environment is really important. So it is not just about how much we eat, but also how we eat and how much we eat and what we eat. That's important for our energy balance. Meanwhile, exercise is obviously a very important issue for prevention of weight gain as well as maintenance of weight loss. So these are both important. However, based on our research, it seems like population-wide, the changes in our food pattern and our food environment has been more dramatic and more directly contributing to the rise in obesity in this population. And I think you could see that. what we have this term is called obesogenic environment. Everywhere we turn, there's food. And oftentimes, we're surrounded by very colorful and very nicely packaged junk food with very little nutrition, but packed a lot of calories, salt, and sugar. Even when we're at home, we and our kids are bombarded with very clever TV ads that tell us we have to buy this snack, that drink, in order to live a better life. That can be further away from the truth. We don't see a lot of ads on fresh fruit and vegetables, right? If I may respond to your question about addiction to sugar.
Sure.
In fact, addiction is a very strong word and has very strict clinical definitions. But in my field, a lot of researchers think that it's a good description of how average Americans have been consuming a large amount of refined carbohydrates and added sugar in their diet. And that's a drastic shift over the past 20, 30 years. Particularly for the public health folks, we're concerned about sugary beverages like soda because it's the largest source of added sugar in American diet.
Yeah, even things that aren't overtly sugary. I mean, clearly pop, you know, soft drinks are sugary. But even things that aren't, that don't taste so sweet, when you look at the ingredients, canned goods and packaged foods, sugar in one form or another is always quite high on the list, you know, so we're kind of bombarded with sugar no matter where you turn, unless you grow everything in your own garden and pretty much raise your food. And that kind of leads to the next thing I wanted to kind of observe. We used to be, you know, 60, 70, 80, 90 years ago, 100 years ago, we used to be a nation of farmers and factory workers. And we moved a lot more during the course of the day. We walked a lot more. We climbed stairs, hoed gardens and harvested crops and so on. And now we're largely, I mean, it's a, you know, simplification, but we're largely a nation of office workers. Right. And so in general, people don't move nearly as much as they used to. Children, for example, used to play vigorously. I did, certainly, outside for hours, you know, until your tongue was dragging, you know. And now they sit in front of a TV or a computer for hours. So there's just such a lifestyle difference that goes along with this. It kind of, the whole thing you were talking about, energy balance, which I guess is energy intake versus energy expenditure, that's one side of it. And the other side is just the environment we live in terms of the food and so on. And it kind of reminds me of the issue in biology of nature versus nurture, or I guess it's in psychology and sociology of how you're born and what your genes are versus the type of raising you have and the environment in which you grow up. And so that kind of two-part impact of food and then the lifestyle seems to be something that put together causes this problem to a great extent. I kind of rambled around there, but if you followed what I'm saying, do you agree with that?
Yeah, definitely. You're absolutely right. But in fact, if we think about it, our genetic pool hasn't changed that much. However, the way we live, the environment around us has changed so much. As you mentioned, now we work in the office and we don't walk to places as much. In many places in the country, we drive to places. And also in terms of, having kids play outside, this actually speaks to a lot of the policy options in thinking about how can we encourage people to move more in their day-to-day activities. Oftentimes we say, well, we should have kids play outside. However, there are some communities don't have pavements or sidewalks. Some communities are challenged with crime. So this gets deeper into a lot of the upstream policy, socioeconomic, environmental issues that we need to dig deeper into. This is not just about, the human race is getting more goodness or lazy. It's just the environment and the way of life has changed.
Yeah, I think that's true. But, you know, but also, yeah, as an important part of that, the food processing industry has changed. I mean, until the 1950s and 60s, I think there was relatively little processed packaged food, and what there was terrible, you know, 25-cent TV dinners that hardly anybody really wanted to eat unless they were starving. But people tended, I think, on balance, to eat fresher foods, and there were fewer chemicals in them because the chemical industry hadn't maybe ramped up, the food processing industry, let's say, hadn't ramped up enough to a sophisticated enough level to really incorporate all of that into nearly all foods. But I really thought myself for many years that there's a good chance that all the preservatives and dyes and other chemical additives in much of what we eat are a large part of the obesity problem, that somehow they cause food to be metabolized differently and for carbohydrates to be fixed in the cells. I don't know if there's anything to that, but it just seems to me that with the ramp up of obesity in the population, it's kind of paralleled the ramp up of chemical additives in food. I mean, when you look at the ingredients of something simple, you know, canned salmon or whatever it might be, it's astonishing how far you have to go down until you get to the salmon on the list. You know, what do you think about that?
Well, that's an interesting hypothesis. I haven't seen any solid evidence in terms of the role of preservatives and additives, and it's definitely a still emerging area of research. However, I do have to agree that the popularity of processed food, and you know, we're talking about highly processed foods that comes in nice packages that would last on the shelf forever, and these foods tend to come from global conglomerates that they process the food and packed in a lot of sugar, lots of calories, and we can consume really quickly. In fact, it's interesting. Brazil recently started to recommend in their dietary guidelines to recommend their people to eat less processed food and eat real food. Very simple recommendation, and it really addresses your concerns about these foods. And one thing I wanted to mention in addition to this is the portion size. So that includes the processed foods as well as fast foods that we purchase has over the years become bigger in size. And we tend to eat what is given. So portion size has explained quite a lot on why we have been consuming more calories than in the past.
Yeah, people kind of laugh uncomfortably about the idea of, you know, supersize that, you know, but you have to kind of specify that you want your Coke at a fast food place in the drive-thru window. That you have to tell them you want only a medium one, you don't want a large one, and it turns out that the extra large one is only 10 cents more than the medium one. So from a standpoint of, you know, getting a more bang for your buck, it seems sensible to get the big one, but by the same token, you're hurting yourself when you do that. So, you know, I was going to ask you about patterns of eating, for example. Is snacking bad? There's so many snacks available, and people grab them at convenience stores on their way from point A to point B. But that has to be a contributor to this problem, I would think.
Right. This is part of the pattern as well. So snacking and more frequent eating, that this culture of we have to have snacks all the time, every day. And the fact that snack foods, have been, as you know, more frequently than not, more the processed foods, sugary things, that definitely contributes to the problem. However, on the positive note, people started to realize that this contributes to the rise in childhood obesity. So there have been many, many initiatives and policies locally to decide, well, we wanted to provide healthier items in schools for our children. So different school districts across the country have implemented different policies to make sure the snack items being offered in a la carte lines, lunch lines, and vending machines in the nation's schools have to be healthy. So I think that is definitely a positive sign of change.
Yeah, that's good to hear. That is a positive trend. You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Dr. Claire Wang at Columbia University about her research area in obesity. I know that, Claire, you study workplace productivity and the impact of obesity on that. We hear about and perhaps see for ourselves that people waste work time on social media and surfing the web and doing personal email, but what about obesity? Your study showed some very specific things. Why don't you kind of summarize it briefly?
Sure. We recently published the study showed that the productivity loss in terms of lost work days associated with obesity and severe obesity across the country adds up to about $8.65 billion. These are the missed work days. We call it absenteeism. So oftentimes, obese and severely obese individuals may struggle with some health issues that they have to miss work. We found that on average, about 1 to 2 extra days of missed work is associated with obesity and severe obesity. But of course, across the country, every state has different wage rates. So the value of these aggregated lost productivity time differs from state to state.
Yeah, okay. So, I mean, you talked earlier about regional differences in obesity, and you mentioned that Mississippi and West Virginia were the two states that had the highest incidence of obesity in adults. But what in general, what are the regions that, you know, kind of rank them in terms of the impact of obesity?
According to the prevalence, the CDC tell us that the CDC data showed that the southern states tend to have higher prevalence of obesity, followed by the Midwest and the northern states and the coastal areas tend to have lower rate of obesity. However, when you think about productivity, there are also states with higher wage rates. So every day lost in these states actually add up to more value in terms of their productivity. The two states that you mentioned, according to our paper, in Mississippi, the annual value of lost productivity due to obesity adds up to about $90 million. In places like New York, the annual lost productivity adds up to about $508 million.
Even though the rate is lower. So obviously that implies that obesity rates correlate with average incomes, right? And I would think with education and with employment numbers, I mean, is that true? It's basically the poorer, less educated population states tend to be more obese?
Generally speaking, yes. Currently, we're seeing that lower socioeconomic status, minority populations tend to have higher rate of obesity than higher income, higher education population. However, the association is stronger in women than in men.
Okay. So, but in gender, in gender in general, are there differences between males and females in terms of the rate of obesity, regardless of where they are?
Well, the difference is not as striking as you would suggest. So, women tend to have slightly higher prevalence of obesity. However, what I pointed to was poverty, food insecurity, low education are more likely to be associated with obesity in women, but not so much in men.
You know, it's funny. I think historically, it used to be that being fat was an indicator of wealth and power because food was hard to come by. And so those who were very overweight tended to be aristocrats, and they were admired and viewed as attractive. You know, the idea of the fat cat, or he's fat and happy. I mean, those are verbal holdovers from that view. But and I think
right.
It still pertains, maybe in some parts of the world that are less modern, let's say, or less developed, or whatever. But it has kind of flip flopped, ironically, in that maybe those who are poorer now are fatter than those who are wealthier. So, you know, on that line of thinking, how does the U.S. compare with other countries? Do you know about that?
Sure. You're absolutely right. There are still some parts of the world where obesity, overweight, are still associated with wealthy people and as a sign of beauty and wealth. However, the picture has changed quite a lot in the United States. Obesity is now so closely tied to poverty, lower income, and underserved communities, that this has become an issue that I think public health and governmental agencies are really looking into. Globally speaking, we started to hear this term globesity. So not just the developed countries, but middle-income and even lower-income countries started to struggle with the issue of overnutrition and obesity, diabetes at the same time. So some region of the world, they struggle with undernutrition and overnutrition in the same population, sometimes in the same community, even the same household, which is very interesting. That also speaks to, when we come back to the U.S. context, it really speaks to a larger issue that's a socioeconomic issue on why it's so challenging to eat a healthy diet when we're struggling financially. So why is that the case that fresh fruit and vegetables have becoming relatively more costly to have than packaged foods, especially sugary drinks, over the years.
Right. It's I sometimes say it's expensive to be poor in some ways, but this is a way in which it's unhealthy to be poor, I guess, because the foods that are most affordable are, in many cases, those that are worse for you. And I've used in this show a few times the word fat, but that term is becoming politically incorrect, I think. I mean, there are euphemisms like plus size and people of size and big, beautiful women. And there are anti-discrimination lawsuits against restaurants, for example, for causing obesity and in the workplace and so on. And I think that I've heard there's now a fat acceptance movement of people who basically say, leave us alone and let us do what we want. It's kind of parallel to the smokers who object to being discriminated against, right? But I see sometimes public spaces have wider chairs now and airlines have trouble accommodating obese passengers. So, you know, do you think that there's a social kind of beginning pressure to sort of normalize obesity in some ways, to take the pressure off of people to diet and feel bad about being overweight?
Well, I agree with you that, you know, we should not discriminate against someone because of the body weight status. And we need to make sure that overweight kids are getting the help they need to live a better lifestyle and getting educated about what to eat and how to exercise without being discriminated against. In my world, I think obesity, rather than being normalized, it is being medicalized. Hmm. So we often refer to obese individuals, as we say in the past, as individuals with obesity. We're treating this as similar to individuals with diabetes. Mm. So we recognize that this is not about personal choices. It's not about a person with weaker will or willpower, but this is a larger societal public health issue that involves all of us. So I think it's a very interesting issue, and I think everyone should be happy with their size, but also do their best to live an active life and eat better. This is about health and not just about the size.
That's right, for the sake of their health. So, well, Claire, we just have a minute or so left, but if you can summarize very briefly in something that in which you may be only guessing, I don't know, but where do you think all of this is heading? Will we continue getting bigger, or, like smoking, will the trend begin to reverse in the near future, do you think?
I'm cautiously optimistic.
Okay.
We're already seeing some latest data showing that the childhood obesity rate is stabilizing and dropping in some states and cities where programs and initiatives are being very aggressive in promoting health. Businesses like Disney, like McDonald's even, are trying to innovate in the business world as well. So I do think that the tide is turning, but more work has to be done, and I think everyone is part of this.
Well, that sounds optimistic, and I hope you're right. Listen, everyone, if you want to learn more about this, a good place to go is Claire Wang's initiative, which is you can Google Obesity Prevention Initiative Columbia. And, of course, she's at Columbia University. So Obesity Prevention Initiative Columbia, and learn more about it. Dr. Claire Wang, I want to thank you so much for being on with us to discuss this important topic.
Thank you, Gord.
And thanks to all of you for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.